Beat Radio, Dreaming of the West. This is Flipside, Studio 865. Todd Steed, along with George Middlebrooks, who's in charge. I'm just making it happen.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, it's too late. You've already agreed to do
this.
I'm
scared now.
Well, should the audience be?
I don't bite. It's just radio. It's just internet.
That's right. And that was, what's your theme? I guess that's my real question. What is the theme here? I'm trying to guess.
My theme is homemade songs. We'll call it that. Everything we're talking about tonight is recorded at home by the people who played the stuff.
So you're saying, as opposed to shelling out $1,000 a day in a recording studio?
Yeah, yeah. So bedrooms, basements, kitchens, whatever. Home recordings, which we're familiar with.
Yeah, bedroom pop is a real thing.
That's right.
It's actually been around for quite a while at this point.
And it's it's always been a thing that I've kind of gravitated toward, and it's it's a thing I've made myself for, gosh, 20 years now, since I first laid hands on a four track and started layering sounds at home. That's a thing I do.
It's an interesting concept, because when the cassette four tracks started to come out, I think in the late 80s, mm-hmm. when they became almost affordable for some of us, and then more affordable for more of us, I mean, lots and lots of people started for the very first time not only being able to multi-track, but at a very relaxed pace. And I just feel a lot of things created that way are much more different than they would have been had they been in a studio with the clock ticking.
Yeah, with the pressure. Yeah, and it depends on what you're going for, too. You know, there's plenty of great punk rock records on four-track where the bands just bang it out because that's what they've got to record on. But I've always kind of tended toward the former and kind of maybe overly labored a song and re-record a part 3 weeks later because I can or whatever. But it does afford you that ability to kind of step back and really consider.
One of the other interesting aspects, I think when the cassette four-track started to bloom, most people didn't release that stuff.
Yeah.
It was, you just didn't.
It's the demo.
That's right. Only the demo.
At least if you're a pro.
And if you're not a pro, you probably didn't have enough money to release the demo because you spent all of it on the cassette four-track.
Right.
The Yamaha MT4,
whatever. MT4X.
Yes. Huh? And then now not only can you record it in your bedroom, you can release it from your bedroom.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Internet.
Is there some kind of gratification for you for just being able to, like, release something seconds after it's finished?
Yeah. Yeah. Even though I don't, because I go back and I listen to it and remix it and remaster it or whatever. But, yeah, it is pretty great to be able to kind of wrap it up on your own. And part of the fun for me is making the cover art. And so I'll design the cover and put it up on Bandcamp and let it sit there for nobody to download.
But
getting it out there is cool. Oh yeah.
Beat Radio. What can you tell me about Beat Radio?
I think they have kind of revolving cast of characters, but the main guy, Brian, lives in New York and just, I think he's pretty much always recorded at home. We were listening back. I said he's got a great sounding basement. He's got just, the whole band's worth of instruments in his house, and I think he does a lot of it himself. But I ran into them through, I think, some MP3 blog probably 10 years ago, and heard their demos, which were slightly rougher versions of the final album. They still kind of had that homemade aesthetic, but they kind of ride the line between having kind of the homemade roughness, four-track kind of sound, you can tell he knows what he's doing, you know? It's John Vanderslice calls it sloppy sloppy hi-fi, where it's, you've got a lot of human feel, but there is actually a lot of fidelity there to it, and I think that kind of takes some work. I think the term lo-fi is kind of slapped on things too loosely.
Yeah, and it becomes a weird reverse marketing ploy.
Yeah, yeah.
When it's not really lo-fi.
Yeah, I think that, like, Beat Radio is a good example of that. You listen to what they're doing, and there's a lot of kind of roughness and distortion, but I think everything's there on purpose. He's not going for any sort of lo-fi, and if you're really listening, you can tell there is a lot of fidelity and there's a lot of quality in the sound. Great songs, too.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to tell the listener what the next one is. I'm just going to play it. and if you know what it is, you'll probably go, oh, of course I know what that is. And if you don't, see if you can guess.
Rock and roll springtime.
Okay, if you're listening at home, I'd love to know what you think that was. You can email me, improv@utk.edu, but by the time you send the email, we'll have already told you. George Middlebrooks is here. He's picking out all the songs. Songs recorded in lo-fi, but not really lo-fi, and that was, of course, Paul McCartney with the Mama Miss America.
Recorded on a four-track, but probably not a Yamaha MT4X.
No, but probably less sophisticated in some ways.
Probably for, what was it, 1969, I guess?
Yeah, 69, 70.
It was like right around the end of the Beatles, 69, 70, making records in his outbuilding or whatever.
And this is a fascinating record. This one draws a lot of lines for people because a lot of people, especially when it came out, just said how horrible it was, even though it did have some supporters even then. But in time, more and more people have gone back to this one, because they're not listening to it right as the Beatles are breaking up. You know, like Abbey Road's not the one right before it.
Yeah, it's pretty heavily loaded at that time.
Yeah.
Like you can't do anything right if you're not doing it with those other three guys if you're a Beatle.
It's just going to sound weird, you know, to like, oh, everything's, there's a lot, so much missing.
Yeah, it's super simple.
And that's why it's so fabulous. This is actually, of McCartney solo albums, this is in my top three easily.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's up there. It's I would say it's my, it fights Band on the Run for my favorite.
And
Ram.
Yeah, those are, those
that's a toughie.
Those are three great ones, and Bits and Bobs of Venus and Mars, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Then things started going terribly wrong. But this one, it's just a cool record. It's just a wonderful, simple, honest thing. Lots of great ideas. What do you like about it?
I love the simplicity of it. I love that it's because it's so stripped down, I think it's got more punch to it. Just you can say the same about a lot of the more stripped down Beatles stuff or you know, music in general, when you kind of strip away a lot of the excess layers. Not to say that all the Beatles excess layers were bad, because it's the Beatles and kind of made them what they are, but you take away a lot and you get a lot more punch out of the sounds that are there and the songs that are there, if that makes sense.
It does, and I always love this record too, because he basically plays everything.
Yeah.
Maybe Linda's on there for a note or two, or there's a sheep in the background or something.
I think there are a couple. Weren't there a couple of Beatles on this one? Seems like Ringo and George actually did stuff on this one.
Really?
I'll have to go back and look. I might be thinking of another one.
Did he give them credit?
Yeah. But he did. I mean, he's a beast of a drummer and guitar player, and he can do everything.
When I saw McCartney play and the guitar solo comes up, and maybe I'm amazed, I remember thinking, I really don't want to hear what his guy's interpretation of his solo is. I want to hear that solo, and of course, the guy played it exactly like McCartney.
Note for note, yeah. He's had time to study.
Oh, yeah. McCartney's so underrated as a guitar player. I just think his guitar playing has so much personality, and so does his drumming, obviously his bass playing.
I never realized, and I'm sure a lot of people don't realize until you go back and, you know, read the books that I've read about the recording notes of all the sessions and everything, but I never realized how much guitar he played on Beatles records. Go back and you can see, like, if there's there's the Recording the Beatles book, the big one, and then there's one Beatles recording sessions that's a little less detailed, but it has a lot to say about who played what, and a lot of notes about where he played guitar, and you look at it and go, he was the best guitar player in the band. I'm gonna get shot for saying that.
Yeah, I love Lennon's rhythm.
Yeah.
He's a great rhythm player, and George was really incredibly tasteful.
Yeah.
And wonderful and
a great simple player. He played down a lot.
And it all fit.
In good ways, yeah.
It all fit. But for me, McCartney's guitar playing, the little there is in the Beatles of him playing lead, but there's more than you think, it's actually probably a lot of my favorite Beatles guitar work, just because it's so full of personality and melody.
Yeah. And you can cross over a lot between that and his bass parts too. It's really melodic. And if you know what you're listening for, you can hear a lot of the same kind of sensibilities there.
I'm finally glad to see him getting his due more and more. I know in England his solo albums became a real hot thing for about 4 or 5 years after, you know, just filling up used record stores.
Yeah.
People just sort of went back and said, these are really unique little records, and these are really jewels, you know, in their own way.
You got to appreciate them for what they are and take away the baggage of the Beatles.
That's hard to do.
Yeah.
But time fixes everything.
Yep.
And after Lennon died, of course, you know, everybody had to canonize and lionize, and you can't hide your lionizing of John Lennon. It's just, I would say I'm going to cut that out later, but I deserve to punish myself by leaving that.
Yeah, that needs to be on public record. But we don't have to talk about the Eagles. We will not talk about the Eagles. Keeping it positive.
We almost did. All right. So coming up next, Spencer Tweedy, Geezer Love, and George Middlebrooks is our guest here on Flipside. Geezer, you probably don't know this. It's one of my all-time favorite words.
Really?
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite bass players.
Geezer Butler, Black Sabbath. I met him once.
Really? No.
He was quite friendly.
I could see that.
Ozzy, not so much.
I could see that.
Yeah. So tell me about Spencer Tweedy and Geezer Love. I just love that. Geezer.
Spencer Tweedy is son of Jeff of Wilco. And when you hear the song, you'll hear a lot of similarities there because genetics are a thing that work. He's really kind of in the last couple of years coming into his own as a songwriter and singer and self-engineer, apparently. He's, from what I understand, he's always played in bands like since he was 10 or whatever. And because how could you not? He released a four-song EP around the end of last year, and it was all recorded just at home and at school. He's in college now and recorded it between home and school and just on his home studio rig, which is, from what I understand, a lot nicer than anything I'll ever lay hands on. But, you know, he's got the Wilco loft at his disposal, but he's still making records on his own with his own little setup, which I think is pretty cool.
You got to admire the son of a very established sort of rock star, you know, to go out and even release stuff because... You know,
at all, yeah.
You're talking about, like, McCartney following the Beatles and how no one's going to be able, at least initially, to disassociate that.
Yeah.
And same thing with, I'm sure, Sean Lennon.
When you open your mouth and it's like so much of your dad's voice is going to come out and people who love your dad's band are going to be immediately either going to give you a little more credit than you maybe deserve or are going to be super skeptical. And I think all those guys kind of got met a little bit of skepticism where somebody said, oh, well, you're ripping your dad off. But you can't help it. I think instincts are a thing that are kind of passed down with artistic instincts. And I think you can hear a lot of that in the music.
So my challenge, George Middlebrooks, is to play Spencer Tweedy, Geezer Love, and then ask the listener, don't think of Wilco.
That's a good challenge.
Just listen to it and don't think of elephants.
Don't think of elephant. It's what we wait for. You
These Are Love, Spencer Tweedy. George Middlebrooks is our guest. He's choosing the songs, things recorded in at home, basically.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at. I mean, I can hear the Wilco. I can hear the Jeff Tweedy in there. And I can also hear something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. He's got that kind of a similar kind of poppy sensibility, but you can tell he's not afraid to get weird with his sounds. And as we were listening, I said you can tell it's really constructed, and you can hear a lot of the pieces being put together. It's more of an arrangement. It's not like just a band banging out a song. And I think that's kind of one of my favorite things about home recordings in general, that usually kind of ends up happening, whether it's intentional or not. You do have that opportunity to kind of construct and piece things together, and everybody's trying to make their Sergeant Pepper. Everybody wants to kind of push the limits of what they're working with.
Well, I grew up in the generation, maybe the last generation that learn their instruments in the rock sort of realm without four tracks. So I got my first four track when I was probably late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd already learned, well, depends who you ask, but I had already at least established my base set of skills on the guitar or whatever way before that. And so, you know, you write a song when you're at pre-home recording, you write a song. You could put it on a tape recorder if you had one, but you're not going to be putting extra things on it.
No.
And you're not thinking arrangement, and you're not thinking construction. And a lot of times, if you didn't have a tape recorder, you'd have to play it so many times that you would not forget it.
Yep.
And that was always weird. I remember.
Well, I still do that.
Do you? That's a good idea. Now I get lazy. I just pull out an iPhone and go, okay, that's close.
Yeah. If I don't play it so many times that I don't forget it, I will play it just enough to record it and forget it immediately. It's gone. Unless I have to get back together with the band to play it live or something, which is rare.
Well, I think one of the results that we're seeing, and more of your generation too, is that more and more people are coming up at very young ages, like Spencer Tweedy, with the skills to, you know, for example, that the warbly guitar you mentioned while we were listening to
it.
You know, I would not have had the skills or the equipment to make the warbly guitar sound.
No.
And if I did at age 17, I would have put way too much on it and ruined everything.
Yep.
So he's probably been able to experiment enough, and he's got access to most of the tools. And not just because he's probably pretty well off, but I think a kid living in Fort Sanders.
Anybody could pull it off at this point.
Yep.
The technology is just ridiculous and just gets better. And I think there's a lot to be said for using a studio and spending $1,000 a day and going in and using, you know, really nice gear and a real recording console is hard to beat. You're not going to get that kind of sound, that kind of fidelity with a USB box going into your laptop. But it's amazing to think of what we can have at home with, you know, a USB box or the plugins and Logic, or just being able to use a multi-track recorder on your computer, whether you actually use the effects or not. Even if you're just doing a four-track punk rock thing on your computer, technology's gotten a lot better.
TLOM, Pictures of Ordinary Things.
That is the Lees of Memory. Your friend and mine, John Davis, formerly of Superdrag. Speaking of the mighty Yamaha MT4X.
Yes.
That's his recording medium of choice, and you know, he's somebody who's made a lot of records and has a obviously a good understanding of what you can do with recording technology, but he chooses to set that limitation of the cassette four track, which I think is pretty awesome. And he also only mixes in mono everything that he does at home with one mic.
This also, and listening to the Lees of Memory and some of John's stuff that I know that he records on a cassette four track, there's also one other thing going on here. There is a sound that the cassette has that digital recording does not have.
Yeah.
And it's not, for me, it's not better, it's not worse, but it is a different sound.
It's like its own instrument. It's another instrument in the arrangement.
And I've gone back through a lot of my cassette four track stuff, And I, you know, at first I think I'm going to wince when I put it on, just when I'm handling the thing. You know, look at this archaic device. And then I put it on and go, oh, I like the sound.
I did that very recently. I thought, oh man, I did this when I was 19 or whatever, and it's going to sound terrible. And it sounds arguably better than some of the other stuff I've done.
Didn't you tell me that you've been recording certain things digitally and then running them into your cassette four track?
I have, and I've done the reverse of that. I'll record on the four track and then run it into Logic, and we're going to get super nerdy, but I'll record on the tape and then run into Logic and create loops or add effects or just kind of further manipulation in the computer.
The Lees of Memory, Pictures of Ordinary Things.
That's just wonderful. You never know what he's going to do from one week to the next, really, because he's always recording and he's always writing, and I really kind of hate him for it.
I felt like that one improved on what Crosby, Stills, and Nash were doing.
Yeah.
You know, like, and who am I to judge anybody, right?
Who are you to judge Crosby, Stills, and Nash?
I know, and I'm getting ready to. They're fine. They're wonderful. Obviously, they've done incredible things. But there are things about Crosby, Stills, and Nash I feel like, they don't do it for me in this regard. And then I felt like that song addressed all those issues and fixed them, like a better hook, an unexpected turn, an unexpected instrument.
Got a little bit weird.
Yeah.
I love that keyboard part.
That's the kind of thing that David Crosby would have said, yeah, let's do it. And then Graham Nash and Stephen Stills would have stepped on his throat.
Yeah. Literally.
One each.
Yeah.
1 foot each. Oh, I think we're out of time.
Oh. Let's fade out with Inner Revolution, because that was the one that got me started on the home recording.
All right.
If that's cool.
Yeah. Adrian Belew.
He
Another Nashvillian.
Another Nashvillian, yeah.
Sort of.
Why not?
Mount Juliet, actually, I believe.